From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan's Syrian community on the U.S. missile strike against Assad.
To be honest, it's way overdue, and I wish the president would have more strong signals to follow.
A Michigan woman talks of her 4 years in prison after being convicted of abusing her infant nephew until a new trial proved her innocence.
I could not show any remorse or guilt for something that I didn't do.
The Red Wings end their time at Joe Louis Arena.
The building is ugly, but the hockey played in that building was beautiful.
As the Pistons leave their home since 1988.
The Palace of Auburn Hills, I hope it is not yet another disposable stadium.
And the tortured life of F. Scott Fitzgerald. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been a week of high emotions for the 10,000 Syrian Americans who live in Michigan. The chemical weapon attacks from the Assad regime that killed Syrian men, women, and children, followed by President Trump's decision to launch American cruise missiles at a Syrian airbase. Just how much hope are Michigan Syrian Americans taking from the president's action? Ishmael Basha is a Syrian-American businessman. He's also a volunteer with SARN, the Syrian-American Rescue Network. Ishmael, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Cindy.
And here with us via Skype, Dr. Amal Majid Katranji. He's a Lansing-based hand surgeon. And since 2011, he's been working with various organizations to help the victims of the Syrian civil war. Dr. Katranji, so good to have you here with us today.
Thanks. Good to be here.
A few days now have passed since that U.S. missile strike on that Syrian airbase that happened on Thursday night with 59 Tomahawk missiles launched to punish President al-Assad for that chemical weapons attack. Ishmael, how are you feeling about that U.S. strike?
To be honest, it's way overdue, and I wish the president would have more strong signals to follow. If this is to be effective, Assad and his allies in the area have to know that this is just not a one-time deal. This is a new White House and new determination to deal swiftly with the problems that Syria has been facing for the past 6 years.
And what about you, Dr. Katranji?
No, I think there's no question that from the American security interests, this was a valuable and necessary move. It doesn't only send a message to Assad. I mean, we got to look at this at a global picture. There's been a progressive pushing of the American will on a global level, whether you see what happens in Crimea and the Ukraine, what goes on in North Korea and the South China Sea. So this is more than just an issue of punishing Assad. It's a reestablishment of the American will on the global political landscape, which I think is long overdue.
You know, it was just a week ago, you stop and think about it, where Secretary of State Tillerson and other administration officials were saying it was up to the people of Syria whether Assad remained in power. And now we hear U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley and Secretary Tillerson saying, no, Assad must go. Ishmael, what do you make of these mixed messages and the very sudden shift?
The mixed messages have been very damaging and encouraging to the regime in Syria and encouraging to Iran and Russia and all the bad elements and ISIS. When you send mixed messages about that, this is not our problem. And I think this mixed message, what have opened the door for Assad to try his luck with the Trump administration. And what I'm saddened to say that even after the attack on the airbase in Syria, Tillerson have repeatedly came back and said, well, our priority that is ISIS now. It is not Assad. While on the other hand, Haley is saying that Assad must go. So it seems like the White House has not gotten his message clear and decisive 100%, because what had taken place, this attack on the airbase, to be 100% effective, the message has to be unified and strong and unmistakable that we are here to assert our interest and to back moderates on the ground and to equally fight ISIS and fight Assad and the Iranian militias and stop Russia from meddling, you know, from the damage and the horrible things that's doing in Syria.
And speaking of being effective, we all know now the day after that U.S. missile strike on that airbase, Assad's fighter jets were using the base again for new airstrikes on the very same town that was the target of the chemical attack. So, Dr. Katranji, what do you think that U.S. missile strike actually accomplished?
I think it accomplished a great deal. I think that despite, look, this Assad is a murderer. And the hard reality is The only people he's been able to ever torture and punish, maim and brutalize are his own. As we've seen over the hundreds of thousands, and I hate to say, hundreds of thousands of bodies that have piled up by his continued barrel bomb attacks, chemical weapons attacks. But what happened was is that with the United States not taking the lead in that environment, he felt he had a free hand. And from other global interests, they've been able to start putting in some of their agendas forward through the Syria process, which makes it then a larger issue. The mission was to say that America is now coming back into the leadership position on the Syria issue. And this has to change Assad's calculus. So building on what Ismail has said, is that the administration now is beginning to create a new understanding, a new Trump doctrine, per se, as it comes to the Middle East in, at large, and Syria in specific. But as we know, what happens in the Middle East does affect us directly as a country. I think this particular action at least now gives the United States ground to not get involved in the conflict, per se, but to take a leadership position again, and at the same time gives it legitimacy to all parties that it stands for principles that all players, including Assad and his father's regime, signed up on, which is that the use of chemical weapons is a crime against humanity.
But Ismail, did it disappoint you when you woke up the next day and heard that they were still flying missions out of that airfield?
It didn't really, because I knew that they are going to do something to as a face-saving measure. This is a face-saving measure to Russia and Syria. And I obviously, you know, they play games, and this is one of their games. They will do anything. You know, they have to look like they are tough, and they have to appear on the outside as if American warhead didn't really hurt them much.
Let's take a listen to what some of what President Trump said on Thursday night as he announced the American action against Assad.
Using a deadly nerve agent, Assad choked out the lives of helpless men, women, and children. It was a slow and brutal death for so many. Even beautiful babies were cruelly murdered in this very barbaric attack.
Now, many have observed that it seems hypocritical for President Trump to be speaking those words at the same time closing America to refugees from Syria. Doctor, what are your thoughts?
No, it doesn't bother me because they're two separate issues. I think that one, he's looking at a conflict in another country, and two, he's looking at the impact of that conflict in the United States, our country. Now, I don't agree with him on his refugee policy, because I believe in a country in which you have a statute of liberty that says, give me your tired, your poor, and your huddled masses, inviting people to come for a new opportunity. We are the land of opportunity, and it's the greatness of our country being an open door to create this great American fabric that's led the world for so long is what makes us strong. It's our diversity. So that's one issue. But on the other issue is that a crime against humanity occurred, and the brutality that everybody's been outlining in Syria that's been going on has often been just exclusively through the ISIS lens, and not many people realizing that there are deep connections between ISIS and the Assad regime and the Putin regimes and Iran, and that these events and this criminal act needs to be appropriately addressed and punished. So I don't have to agree with our president on everything, but I do believe firmly that our president did a great job leading when it came to this issue.
Ismail, your thoughts?
Honestly, if Obama had dealt with the Syrian conflict swiftly and had not allowed Assad to cross that red line in 2013, the refugee problem would not be here today to be talking about it. The refugees became a world problem and almost near brought Europe to its knees, and now it's becoming a United States problem, is because Assad and Iran and Russia have had free hand to do whatever they want to do for the past 6 years. And I'm so glad that President Trump is finally standing up and willing to do something about it.
And we do know that the bombing and the attacks have not ended. Men, women, and children are still dying as they have been for far too long. So what do each of you hope for from the Trump administration going forward? Doctor?
There's an optimism here in the sense that if this new dialogue, if this new approach by our administration is going to be taken with regards to the Assad and recognizing then the fact that the very players are the same evil that we have to deal with in Syria, ISIS and Assad are one and the same. I think that it creates a new dynamic for the moderates to finally have a voice And there are a lot of moderates, who have been suffering for 6 years now. We're talking millions of moderates who've been displaced out of their country. I think that if our president now consolidates our policymaking when it comes to Syria and engages those millions on the basis of creating a new opportunity in Syria, which I also think then will stabilize not just simply Syria, but issues in Turkey, Jordan, Israel, from a regional level, as well as reassure some of our allies in the Middle East, I think he's going to find some very strong alliances within Syria itself to bring about stability, which brings a stable Syria, a democratic Syria that has a good future. It's a rebuilding process, and none of this is going to happen overnight, and there's no magical solution. But I think the first crystallization of this act by the president last week, if it's followed through with a tiered mission of engagement with that center that exists, I think we'll have a very positive outcome for the future.
And Ismail, your hopes from the Trump administration?
You know, this this attack on the airbase, I am sure eventually is going to lead to some form of negotiation, hoping for political settlement in Syria. And I'm hoping when there is meeting with the Syrian regime that they know that the moderates have somebody to really back them up with an action, not just with words. Now I am hoping the dynamics would change and would change swiftly. You know, that the regime had really no consequences for them to come with sincerity to negotiate political settlement because there are no consequences for their actions. They knew that. I hate to say the Obama administration made it more than clear that there is no consequences for all the brutality and the killing and the murderous actions on the ground. So I'm hoping that this their calculus have changed 180 degrees.
So much to talk about, but we are very grateful for your points of view, Dr. Abdelmajid Katranji and Ismail Basha, members of Michigan's Syrian American community. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sadie.
Coming up, the alcohol battle of writer F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Some days he said, I drank 30 beers, and he was proud of that because he wasn't drinking the hard stuff.
And then in 20 minutes, we'll hear from Julie Balmer. She served 4 years in prison for an erroneous child abuse conviction. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. Pistons playing their final game tonight at the Palace of Auburn Hills. The Red Wings, of course, said goodbye last night to Joe Louis Arena on Detroit's riverfront. Both teams preparing to move into their new home, Little Caesars Arena, next fall, and under a bit of a cloud. This is the first time since 1983 that neither team has made the playoffs.
That's amazing, by the way, and we're a bit spoiled as far as that goes locally. In the case of Joe Louis, it was a building put up kind of slapdash, frankly, to make sure the Wings did not go to Oakland County.
Because they were talking about going out
very
to
seriously
Pontiac.
At that point.
Yes.
This is before the Illiches, of course, were on board. Mm-hmm. Joe Louis had old plans, like 10 or 15 years old as it was. They forgot to put in a press box, so they had to tear out a couple rows of seats to jam us up there, and it feels exactly that way. It's a horrible, it's not even a press box. They had too few bathrooms. You might recall this.
Yes, they do.
The long history, even now they do, but yeah. Even it used to be worse, the long history of men urinating in the sinks.
Whew.
That is one sink you don't wash your hands in. So
if it's bad for the men, imagine how it was for us.
Oh, well, the line out the door was ridiculous for the women, of course.
Right, so. And no view. Here you are on the river, and you would never know it.
Why would you build a building on the river with no windows?
Yeah.
And as far as I get the idea of trying to, you know, give Detroit some more energy downtown, but you've got 8 lanes of Jefferson, so you might as well build a moat. It's like the Renaissance Center. There's no crossover traffic,
it's
really.
It's an awkward site, isn't it?
Very awkward site. Here's my point. The building stinks. The building is ugly, but the hockey played in that building was beautiful.
Yeah.
Honestly, over the last 30 years, it was the best place to watch a hockey game in terms of the quality of the product on the ice.
And as many say, there was not a bad seat to be had when you were sitting there. It was beautiful hockey with great sight lines.
It was ultimately a very functional building, but very good for hockey.
Mm-hmm.
And the players, of course, have got strong feelings about it. They've been to fancier arenas, for sure, and they're about to go to one.
Yes.
But their feelings for that place are real, and my memories there are very strong.
I will point out, is I was talking to younger folks that when the Red Wings moved from Olympia, people felt the same way. Like, how could you leave Olympia, the venerable Olympia? Didn't
they?
I would
even say they felt very strongly that way. No one feels that way about Joe Louis, though. The Olympia is this beautiful old, you know, brick barn, the classic one. Yeah. In hindsight, you try to restore it, you know, and keep it going like Fenway or Wrigley Field. No one feels that way. Very few feel that way about Joe Louis. They may feel emotional about the place, but not the actual building.
All right.
So,
and looking at the Palace, and I can remember going to my very first concert right after it opened. It was Michael Jackson. Went in, and this was like, oh, this is sharp. This is great. I remember getting lost because I couldn't figure out where I was on the
concourses, right?
Came out on the completely wrong side late at night in the cold looking for my car. But that was a concert place for us, as had been the Silver Dome.
Mm-hmm.
And now we know the Silver Dome's in tatters and going down. Palace, we don't know yet what its future holds.
Dicey in both cases. What I don't get, in the case of the Silver Dome, the Palace is going to lose 41 home basketball games. That's, you know, almost one a week, obviously. Mm-hmm. That's very significant to the overall business plan. NFL stadiums host 8 home games. That's it. 8 dates out of 365. That can't be the whole of your business plan. And if it is, you're a very bad business person. So they had the tractor pulls. They had
rock concerts.
I saw the Rolling Stones there, their first farewell tour in 1981.
For me, it was The Who. In fact, I think The Who set a record when they first played at the Silver Dome for the largest indoor crowd.
There you go. Probably 85 or so at that point,
like,
with the floor.
70s.
So how did they let this happen? The building was in fine shape until they let it go to hell, basically. The roof wiped out and so on. Mm-hmm. I don't get what the whole thinking was behind that place. Hmm. They could have filled it, I think, with a lot of other things. Tearing it down costs money. It's well built. It's very strong. That's going to cost money. The Palace of Auburn Hills, I hope it is not yet another disposable stadium. In the last about 35 years, American taxpayers have paid about $21 billion, of taxpayer money for over 100 arenas, ballparks, stadiums, and they almost always get screwed on the deal no matter what you're being told.
Which we're seeing. I mean, we know that there's taxpayer dollars in the Little Caesars Arena.
In a city that can least afford it.
Interesting. And as
I give the Illiches credit
for
being very civic-minded. They've been very, very good at Detroit in many, many ways. I don't want to dump on that. However, this idea of taxpayers paying for stadiums makes no sense. Economically, it does not work.
Michigan Radio sports commentator John Hugh Bacon. As always, thanks, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
Vision.
Part of the community. The next idea.
Our infrastructure is our collective ability to say what we care about.
Take the combined brain power of Michigan State University, University of Michigan, and Wayne State University, and apply all that brain power to solving the water infrastructure problems that we face, not only in Flint, but across Michigan. That's the idea behind a new program launched by Michigan's Research Corridor Schools. It's called In Water, Infrastructure Network for Water. Michigan State University's Joan Rose is an internationally recognized expert in water microbiology, water quality, and public health safety. And she's the 2016 recipient of the Stockholm Water Prize, which is the world's most prestigious water award. Joan Rose, it's a pleasure to welcome you to The Next Idea.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Joan, as we look at this pilot program In Water, help us understand, how will this work on the ground?
So we've asked leaders to come to a series of workshops and to start thinking about a roadmap for what an in-water infrastructure network in water would look like. These are people from government, from private industry, nonprofit, and academic. We want to create this idea of what might we do, what would the roadmap look like to actually move knowledge to practice. Where are the gaps? And who needs to be at the tables? Who needs this knowledge? And, of course, we believe that within a city structure, city managers, utilities are the people that need to come together and be thinking about water and communicate that to the populace.
So this pilot program, did the Research Corridor Schools view In Water as a response to what's happened in Flint, or is the idea more far-reaching than that?
Certainly Flint and the struggles there, you know, all the suffering that the community has precipitated a national dialogue around water and the need to rethink how we get innovation, how we get new treatment technologies, how we get more monitoring into small communities in particular, or into communities that are struggling with their water infrastructure.
What is the mission of In Water, in your view?
Our mission is really to take the brain power of universities and create a network that translates knowledge into practice. There's often a barrier to bringing in new technology into the drinking water space. Linking that whole idea of the water cycle with humans, human needs, and ecosystem services. And we want to be able to really move technologies, better information, better knowledge into decision-making for communities.
That idea of taking research that you're all doing and turning that into action, is that a heavy push?
It is in many cases. You know, universities have such broad-ranging research endeavors, everything from, you know, studying the molecules and the nanoparticles within water to very practical innovations around technology or sensors. But often we don't get the opportunities to test those out in the real world to understand how the new information and the new data can actually be turned into knowledge that really makes a difference in normal people's lives.
So that all of that knowledge and all that research, the idea is to get in there and help communities and local governments get their water systems updated.
That's right. And we know that our grandparents and our parents, when we think back 30 years ago, when we started looking at the reauthorization and the development of the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act, they did a fantastic job thinking about that future. But now we're 40, 50 years down the road, and we have to now start thinking about what we're going to do for that future generation. In 50 years, what are our great-grandchildren and grandchildren going to think about the decisions that we made?
Water doesn't exist alone, as I know you know very, very well. There are other considerations like land use and electricity. How do you focus a project like this with all of this that's not just about pipes?
Absolutely. It's not just about pipes. And we know that solving these big problems requires a multidisciplinary approach. We need to have people from various sectors come to the table to solve the problem. It's interesting. We're learning from other networks that are out there, and there's many, many networks in the energy space, transportation space, and actually already in the water space. So what's missing? Why are we still not meeting the needs of communities in addressing safe water? Do we need a network of networks? Do we need better communication strategies? We know that these things are connected. We know energy needs water and water needs energy. You know, we are thinking about, geez, how do we look at the smart city, the 21st century city in which water and transportation, internet, you know, connectedness is going to be important, where waste can be treated and resources can be recovered, food and resources can flow into the city and needs and goods can flow out of the city.
Other states, even Canada, we know are facing many of these same aging infrastructure issues. Do you see in water as something that could be a useful model for others to follow outside of Michigan?
Oh, yes. We know we have to think about a mission. Nothing really gets started without people that have a passion and an interest. And so you start there. But we do think that this could be a model for many other networks that need to produce something for communities nationally, maybe even globally. You know, the Great Lakes have always been seen in a leadership role around water quality. With the water quality agreement between Canada and the U.S. and this important international freshwater basin. And we think that those lessons will serve us well as we start to look at this one water concept. That is from the source to the tap and back to the source. How do we innovate our infrastructure and how do we do the best for our communities to provide safe water and really protect the biohealth of the planet?
In Water, the infrastructure network for water, harnessing a whole lot of brain power to tackle the problem of our aging water infrastructure. We've been talking with Joan Rose, an internationally renowned water scientist from Michigan State University, along with the University of Michigan and Wayne State University. They're working together to launch In Water. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing all of this work with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
an American classic written by one of America's greatest authors. The Great Gatsby was published on this day in 1925. Even though readers today still buy 500,000 copies of The Great Gatsby every year, and it's sold over 25 million copies, been made into a movie 5 times, F. Scott Fitzgerald went to his grave thinking he had written a flop. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markel is here with more on the tortured life of F. Scott Fitzgerald, or as you say, the publication of The Great Gatsby, A Rhapsody in Gin. Mm-hmm. So this
that was
is
his favorite.
His
boost.
favorite tipple.
Yeah.
Now, you've taught Fitzgerald to your students for a long time. Why is that?
Because if you want a case history of alcoholism and what it can do and the progressive path untreated to death, you could not find a better case than Fitzgerald, nor a more beautifully documented case, because Fitzgerald wrote so wonderfully.
And spoiler alert, everybody, he dropped out of a heart attack at age 44. So let's talk about it seems that that should not have been a surprise. You call him a badly recovering alcoholic.
Yeah, he quit 100 times or more, quit every day, actually. And he was in Hollywood trying to make it as a screenwriter. Now, imagine Fitzgerald wrote these wonderful, lush sentences, and writing movies is exactly the opposite. Mm. And so he had a hard time succeeding as such. And, of course, his drinking cost him several jobs as well. But he had literally drank and smoked himself into death, and he died of a heart attack. He had cardiomyopathy or a big, swollen, floppy heart. Mm. He had terrible coronary arteries that were plugged up with cholesterol. He died at a much younger age than he should have.
His heavy drinking started at a tender age, and there was a family history.
Yeah. By the time he was at Princeton as an undergraduate, he was already drinking too much. And he basically spun that roulette wheel of bad fortune and came up with bad numbers each time. So he had a strong family history. His father was an alcoholic. And there were other relatives who were alcoholics. He talked about having a very small ego. He was he felt insecure in front of others. He had some psychological trauma. All you have to do is say the word Zelda. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the most traumatic marriage in the history of American literature. And he just didn't do very well with alcohol. And he also got drunk very easily. And he also liked to exaggerate his drinking symptoms and would get into fights. He'd throw things at people. He'd land in jail. He'd get beaten up. And he did this all along the Eastern Seaboard and in many parts of Europe.
What would be a typical day's drinking for F. Scott Fitzgerald?
Well, my favorite story is when he is in Hollywood. He had a young secretary named Frances Kroll, and she would take dictation for him. But her first job when she came in the morning was to take a burlap bag filled with empty gin bottles and drive them far away from where Fitzgerald was living so no one would know how much he was drinking. Some days he said, "I drank 30 beers," and he was proud of that because he wasn't drinking the hard stuff. He drank quite a bit, and then he went through periods where he didn't drink as well. Some of those periods, when he was, for example, at MGM, he was drinking 30 or 40 bottles of Coca-Cola and eating candy bars and homemade fudge, because recovering alcoholics in their early phase of quitting or going on the wagon, they like to have sugar. And so he would do that to compensate for the sugar he was missing by not drinking the booze.
And when he did die, what exactly happened?
Well, he was in his apartment. He had a girlfriend, Sheila Graham, who was the famous gossip columnist. Zelda was by then in an insane asylum.
Yes.
And he had had chest pain the night before. They went to a movie premiere, and he said, "I'll get it checked the next day." And, of course, he did not, and he had his fatal heart attack. At his funeral or his wake, he had the finest morticians powder him up and dye his hair and put makeup to obscure the wrinkles on his face. Mm-hmm. Because if you see the photographs of Fitzgerald at the end of his life, he looks like an old man. My favorite part of the wake was the great Algonquin wit, poet, and quite a drunk in her own right, Dorothy Parker, who was also a screenwriter.
Yes.
And both loved Scott Fitzgerald's work and often called him a horse's ass for his drunken behavior. But she looked over him and said, "The poor son of a bitch." And when that got out, people thought it was Dorothy Parker being Dorothy Parker. But actually, it's what Owl Eyes says at the end of Great Gatsby, looking over Gatsby's dead body. She was quoting Fitzgerald.
She was indeed. And when he died, by then, Great Gatsby had pretty much withered on the vine, hadn't it?
It was out of print. And he literally went to his grave thinking he was a failure. So his old chum and sometimes arch enemy, Ernest Hemingway, was, you know, on the ascent. And Fitzgerald was barely read by anybody. It wasn't until the 1950s, there was a big biography of him that came out at that time. And then more and more people began to read him. And then, thank goodness, we all read him now.
You've got to wonder what might have happened if he'd been able to conquer those demons.
There probably would have been some more better novels. And the one that's unfinished, The Last Tycoon, which was about Hollywood, it's quite a good book in its own right, but I sure would have liked to have read it in its finished form.
University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell, as we mark the anniversary of the publication of The Great Gatsby by the very troubled and tortured F. Scott Fitzgerald. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, a Michigan woman tells us of her 4 years in prison for a crime she did not commit.
You can just imagine the hell. You can just imagine.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just imagine serving more than 4 years in prison for a crime you did not commit. Our next guest, Julie Baumer, does not have to imagine it. She lived it. Last month, after numerous failed attempts in previous legislatures, Michigan became the 32nd state to offer compensation to people who have been wrongfully convicted and exonerated. They're now eligible for $50,000 for every year they served in prison, plus other support services. For the next three Mondays, we'll feature people who are eligible for this new compensation. The first is Julie Baumer. We spoke recently at her attorney's office in Detroit about the effort to clear her name. Julie, let's start by talking about the chain of events that landed you in prison. You're exonerated now, but this chain of events that all began with what?
Well, in 2003, my sister gave birth to a little boy in whom she was unable to care for. With the blessing of my family, I decided to proceed with an in-family adoption. And Philip was born 2 weeks premature, if you will, by the induction of medical staff through the use of Pitocin. Right after his birth, he was hospitalized in the neonatal intensive care unit, and it was from our understanding that he was just going to be lethargic or slow beginning, if you will, for whatever reasons. So when he was 5 weeks old, he stopped eating for me. So I called his pediatrician after about 12 hours of him not taking down a feeding. I asked her, what would you recommend that I do? Because his temperature doesn't seem to be off, and I, of course, had all these parenting books, and you're going through, you know, troubleshooting and whatnot. And so I wasn't really sure, you know, what was going on. I just knew that he wasn't keeping a feeding down. So she suggested that I take him into the ER room so that they could immediately do an IV to keep him hydrated, and then they would assess the situation from there. When I took him into the ER room, he was there for probably about 2 hours before they decided to transfer him to a children's hospital. And then it was 12 hours after that point that we were notified. The doctor on staff stated that there was a nurse that was doing daily checks and that the circumference of his head had grown alarmingly enough for them to do a CAT scan and MRI. And upon that, they saw bleeding on the brain. And because I was the last person with Philip, I was, of course, the prime suspect of alleged child abuse, baby shaken syndrome.
What was that moment like when suddenly you realized that they were looking at you and thought you had hurt that baby?
It was surreal. It wasn't something that I, of course, it didn't cross my mind. It didn't cross the mind of anybody in my family or whatnot. It was something that is this really happening? Or, you know, is there a way to get a second opinion?
And then you're charged, you wind up on trial, and you're found guilty. Take me to that moment when you heard that word guilty.
Well, when I heard the guilty verdict, again, that was a surreal moment. Is this really happening? How did we get to this point? It was devastating. I knew that it was going to be a collapse in my life, with a ripple effect going everywhere in every dynamic part of my life, personal and professional. Immediately, I just knew that I had to appeal it and go through the process of trying to prove my innocence.
What was your sentence?
Initially, the sentencing guidelines, if you will, were 1 to 4 years. However, the sentencing judge
he gave me the maximum, which was 10 to 15. Of course, I knew that worst case scenario would be the full 15 because I would never see a parole board, and I could not show any remorse or guilt for something that I didn't do. I couldn't own up to something that I didn't do. So I pretty much was calling it the 15 years.
Tell us how you handled day-to-day life in prison. On one hand, you're hoping that an appeal will work, but on the other hand, you just said you kind of were resigned to the full 15.
Oh, that's a pretty big question because there are so many different degrees to it, if you will. But basically, you follow the rules and you try to be as cordial and as polite to everyone around you, and minus all of the chaos and the drama that's involved in or that goes on in an environment such as that. I tried to maintain the same schedule that I would outside, that I had outside. You know, I made sure that I had a daily job, and in the evenings I would resort to reading or writing for a form of entertainment, and then of course I would just go walk the track. I did a lot of walking just to pass the time.
Take us up to the point where the door opened to this exoneration that finally happened. How did that all come together?
In September of 2007, I was denied my appeal by the Michigan Supreme Court, and so I pretty much realized that I had exhausted the appeals on my end as far as I was able to do. Of course, I was indigent. I had been imprisoned now for 2 years going on three. I've always been religious, and I was born and raised Catholic, but of course I just started giving all the glory to God instead of asking him, why is this happening to me? I began my prayers with, how can I glorify you in this situation? And by December of 2007, I was contacted by a nun out of the Felician Sisters of here in Livonia, and she basically asked if there was any legal counsel that I might need, and of course I said yes, and so she knew of a professor at the Ave Maria School of Law. Currently it's no longer in Michigan, but he and his class were willing to take me on as a class project. The students, of course, found merit in my case. They knew that they were in pretty deep. And so ironically and through the grace of God, simultaneously that same year, the University of Michigan opened up their exclusive non-DNA innocence project. And so we were able to, with their assistance, and then assistance of counsel from out-of-state, Heather Kirkwood, who specializes in the defense for those accused of baby-shaken syndrome, if you will. She was the one that was able to bring in these world-renowned doctors who independently wrote these affidavits. After seeing these radiology CAT scans, it's very clear that this child did not suffer any form of abuse, but rather a form of childhood stroke, venous sinus thrombosis.
When did the moment happen when you heard the words exonerated and you're getting out?
Well, of course, I always claimed that from day one. So I just didn't know when, but I knew it was going to happen. I did allow myself to have that much faith in the legal system where the miscarriages would be corrected, if you will. However, it was in early 2009 when I was informed that the judge would be overturning my conviction. We weren't sure if the state was going to re-pick up the case or whatnot, but for whatever reason, it took a few months for all of the paperwork to go through or however that falls and goes into play, but it wasn't until November of 2009 that I actually received a visit from Charles Lugosi, who was the professor originally on the case, and he said, they've overturned your conviction. They know that you're innocent. Unfortunately, at that point, I was informed that the state was going to retry me, so I wasn't exactly released from custody at that point. I had to wait about 2-3 weeks for a court hearing, if you will, and then it was at that court hearing where I was recharged. It was almost like a new arraignment. I was recharged, and then I had to bond myself out. I had family willing and waiting to do that, and then they put a tether on me, and I waited 10 more months for the second trial.
And what changed in the second trial?
A lot of things changed. I don't want to say that my initial trial attorney didn't have faith in me or my innocence. I think that a lot of things were above and beyond his knowledge, and he just didn't reach out for the proper resources that he should have. So, of course, in my second trial,
instead of having one attorney, I had a plethora of attorney, including students who were actively working for the Innocence Project. And like I said, these experts, you need experts, pro bono assistants. They independently read these medical records and they all came to the same conclusion.
So you'd been out with a tether, but then you were found not guilty in that second trial.
Right.
And now this thing was off your back at last. So after all that time, you were in prison for a total of how many years?
I was convicted in September of 2005 and I was released in December of 2009.
So these lost years of your life and earning power, wrongfully convicted, what were you given to help pick up your life as a free person again?
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. I was given the, you're not guilty, you're free to go.
And when you stop and realize that parolees in Michigan get help with things like housing and medical care and job placement, but here you are, exonerated after spending all those years in prison unjustly and not one iota of support.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything from even just a simple apology. Several times I've stated in different situations, and it's the best analogy that I can come up with is, you know, I was in my formative years, mid to late 20s, and I was trying to build my life and networking and just basically the foundation to get to a lifestyle that one would desire. And all of that was taken from me, and it was just given back to me in a bag, if you will, with missing pieces. So I was trying to put together this jigsaw puzzle, if you will, and you can just imagine the hell. You can just imagine.
So tell us a little about your life today. What are you working on? What are you doing? What have you been doing in terms maybe of education or retraining?
I'm currently working on my BA to finish schooling. Prior to my choice to return to school, for 4.5 years I was employed with a local parish, which I was gratefully employed for because it was a steady income, it was a good environment, and through that I was able to rebuild my credit and purchase a home. And so I did that in 2013. However, we're in 2017, and I'm still behind on so many different levels, if you will. For somebody who's 40 years old, I'm very, very behind. If there was emotional and psychological support immediately upon release, medical support upon release, who knows, things could probably be a little different. But again, when you're, like I said, you're given your life back and there's missing pieces, there was no manual to say, how do you do this and how do you handle this and how you can predict this and whatnot. So you just take it on a day-to-day basis, no matter how cliche that sounds, but mm-hmm. That's all you could do.
The state's new law grants $50,000 per year for every year spent in prison and reentry services to exonerees like you. But it's all new, and at this point, you're not sure how you're going to proceed or when you're going to proceed to go after that. Let's say you do, and it all works out. You're able to prove that, yes, indeed, you were wrongfully convicted. What would you do with that money?
With that money, I think the only logical thing that I could do with it would be to invest it and allow it to grow and in some way give it back in some form or manner to the injustices that I personally experienced while being under the care of the Department of Corrections. You know, so many times did I see young women going through the revolving door process, if you will, and it's like, even though it's the Department of Corrections, and I'm really not trying to, you know, impugn what they're trying to do in the overall sense, but in realistically, from my aspect, and from a lot of inmates' aspects, it's the Department of Housing. It's where society's rejects are sent. And so what I would like to do is try to implement some form of programs for those wrongfully convicted or otherwise, where they can strive to better themselves and be the best versions of themselves while incarcerated and after incarceration.
I'm interested in how your nephew is today. And do you see him? And are you in contact with your sister?
My nephew, he was adopted out before I was even convicted. There's obvious other flaws in other areas of the system. During my second trial, I did make contact with the adoptive parents through my attorneys, hoping to build a bridge between the two families. But unfortunately, when the not guilty verdict was returned, the family turned cold on me, if you will, meaning that it was quite obvious that they didn't want to have any contact between the two families. So I don't know his present condition.
Julie, how are you doing in terms of forgiving the injustice that was done to you?
Well, because there was several factors in my case that I would have to believe that brought the guilty verdict originally, if you will, all I can say is that, you know, we're all humans and we're all subject to error. And, of course, you know, our criminal justice system, you know, it's like a machine, and it needs to be maintained to keep the wheels spinning. And if there's any form of kink in that maintenance of this machine, if you will, of course there's going to be errors, or there's going to be the results of wrongful convictions or injustices, if you will. So I would have to think that I can't say, oh, I forgive any one entity, but I do acknowledge that there is error. And it's just unfortunate that those who could have corrected this before it accelerated to the point that it could have, especially one of the doctors stating, I might have been wrong, but I don't want to go back into my other cases, and I have a practice, and I have a reputation, and I have a family, so if I was wrong about this one, how many more have I been wrong against? So I'm not going to change my testimony for the second trial. It's just, it's one's pride, and like I said, it's just not one particular entity. There was several, and it's just unfortunate that human error and the neglect of acknowledging that or owning up to it, if you will, results in what happened to me.
So when you were accused and went through the whole trial and you're found guilty, how did that affect your relationship with your family and with your friends?
Well, of course, this originated and stemmed from my younger sister having an addiction problem. Just growing up in the environment and the family that I did, we were always taught not to air your dirty laundry, if you will. So, of course, in my personal setting amongst my family and whatnot, you know, everybody was on the up and up of what was actually happening in regards to the in-family adoption and how it came to be or whatnot. But in my professional life, I really didn't share a whole lot of the negative aspects or how things were transpiring. In fact, realistically, I almost lived a double life all the way up until the time of my conviction. At the time, I was actively involved in a local Kiwanis group, and I was the president at that time. And I remember the next day, had I not been convicted, I would have still carried on with a board meeting that had been scheduled a month before. And so I was just trying to really keep my life and know I really didn't expect a guilty verdict. So I just figured, okay, we'll move that out of the way and continue moving forward and, you know, just hope for the best.
And what about now? How are things now?
I would have to truthfully say that I wish that they were better. But realistically, after my incarceration, of course, I had full support from my family. But people in my professional and associate life, if you will, those who you associate with, they did contact my father and, you know, well, what's going on? We read about this in the paper, or, you know, what's the status of this or that? So I had heard that I had a lot of people inquiring about, you know, what's going on with Julie, but nobody actually contacted me directly. To be in prison, it's very, you're very isolated, and you have a lot of solitude time, if you will, and so you have a lot of time to reflect. And I guess the only thing that I came up with was to excuse their behavior or their lack of concern, if you will, was people handle situations differently. You know, if my office mate, who I had been an office mate with for 3 years, if all of a sudden he came to me and said, I'm dying of cancer and I have 3 months, how would I respond to that? How would I, you know, I mean, you know, you can mull it over in your head a million and one times, but, you know, it is what it is. And unfortunately, after I was exonerated, truthfully, I guess I was a little bitter because I did have some people that reached out, but it was like, well, where were you 3, 4, 5 years ago, you know, when I needed your support and your assistance and whatnot. So I just, I've maintained sort of that solitudeness, if you will, and right now I just focus on caring for my elderly father and providing a roof over our heads, and like I said, that's all I can do.
That was Julie Baumer. She served 4 years in prison for a crime she didn't commit. She is now eligible under a new Michigan law to receive $200,000 in compensation. Join us next Monday for the story of a Detroit man also set to receive compensation for his wrongful conviction. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.